Join me, Matt Hackett, and Ben Anderson, also known as game dev and YouTuber Heartbeast, as we discuss Ben's book Production Point.
And I got to this point where you're trying to make a great game instead of trying to make a game and see if it's great.
When to pivot to a side project.
Quit. Just quit. Do something else.
Game engine preferences.
I really love using Godot for making games.
And Ben's new game, Wassered.
It's time. It's time for me to make a game.
You're listening to Make the Game with Matt Hackett.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for being here today. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we've been chatting recently, and I read your awesome book, Production Point. We've got so much good stuff to talk about. The first thing on my mind, though, is I think it was our first chat. You casually dropped in this term in the middle of a sentence, and it hit me so hard, I forgot the rest of your sentence, right? It was main project syndrome, and it hit me like a train. I was like, "What? Wait, I don't know what that is, but I have that. I have it. I have it now. I've had it before. I know what that is, but I don't know what that is." So you said it, and I was like, "We need to circle back to that." So I think this is the perfect opportunity. We're going to get to listener questions. We're going to talk about your amazing 200,000 plus YouTube subscriber channel, book stuff, and your next game, Wassered. But I want to start with main project syndrome. I'm dying to know, like, what does it mean to you?
That's a good question. I think it's one of those things where if you've been in it, you know what it's like, but it can be hard to describe. And that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I felt it very much with my project Demon Lock. It was kind of, you know, this big project that I'd started with my brother. I'd been working on it for like 2 years. I'd done a bunch of YouTube videos and devlogs about it. And it turns into this like giant amalgamation in your mind that is hard to getting any work on it feels like. Any work done feels difficult, you know? And I think what happens with it, one way to describe it would be when I was working on Demon Lock, I got to a point where there was like all this expectation and all this pressure around the project. And some of it might have been because of having a YouTube channel and releasing that content on YouTube. But I think a lot of it was myself. Like I put all this pressure on myself to make this amazing thing because I'd shared it with other people. And you get to a point, and I got to this point where you're trying to make a great game instead of trying to make a game and see if it's great. And kind of like evaluating it after you've made it, as opposed to like evaluating it before you've made it. And before you've made it, there's like an infinite possibility space, you know, you could go so many directions and you're like trying to evaluate if it's good or not. And I don't know, it's hard to describe, but I saw a devlog on YouTube actually, which was by Sock Pop. I don't know if you have heard of them.
I'm very familiar.
Yeah, so they released Stacklands, right? That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Stacklands, their card game. And there was a devlog about it. And the creator of that game was talking with one of the other people in the company, you know, in their little group, their little boy band, as they like to refer to themselves. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, you need to stop trying to make a good game. You just need to make a game and then see if it's good. Mm-hmm. And like that hit me hard too when I was watching that devlog. You know, and I don't know where I came up with the term main project syndrome. I was talking about it with my brother, I think. And that's what it feels like. Like that term just, it had a feeling to it. That's why I used it.
I love it. Yeah, it really made me think. I just listened to catching up with some of your content, the first episode of your new podcast, which is on Spotify. Your first episode, it was like 16 minutes long, and you were kind of talking about this sort of problem, right? I experienced this a lot myself, where like I think about my career is like having these touchstones of games, right? Like it used to be Onslaught Arena, then it was a Wizard's Lizard, and now it's Witchmore. And it's these games which they feel like they kind of take over, right? Like they go past this line where you like this line of sanity or something. Yeah, I have this for sure. I have it now. I've had it before, and I don't always have it. Something interesting you talked about in your book, Production Point, is this kind of line that you'll draw where you will hit a point with the project where you know it's ready to hit production, right? And I'm, as I'm reading your book, I was like, I hit that with Witchmore, where like I pulled the trigger and I jumped to production before I had proved all that stuff out, right? And I know why I did that is because I had main project syndrome. You know what I mean? I'd put all this time and love and effort into a thing, and I wanted it to be great before I knew it was. In fact, it's not great, right? Like, it's interesting because you can look at like some of the videos I've posted. Some of my most ardent followers are like, I'm confused by this. Like, I don't know what you're trying to sell here, you know? Main project syndrome. That was the thing I was going to mention about your first episode of your podcast. You're talking about language. You were talking about these terms you kind of set, which was so relatable to me, right? Because like you said, you're not classically trained. And so sometimes you'll make up things like pre-production or production, and you set the stage for like other studios do use those terms, but you wanted to like people to understand that you might use them differently. And from what I've seen, that's different for like every studio, right? Like they all treat these like prototype. If you say that word, you kind of are in the same ballpark with most people, but you are not on the same, you're in the same chapter, but not the same page with almost any developer, like their definition of a prototype. You know what I mean? And that's one of the things I found so handy about Production Point is that like, this is the kind of book where after I read it, I was like, I've been so stupid. You know what I mean? Which means it was good and it was impactful. And what's interesting about your first podcast as well is you were talking about how you're working on your next games through the process of Production Point. I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, like, you know, having written the book, now using it as a guide for yourself to make your games.
Yeah. So the idea for Production Point came from Demon Luck and feeling that main project syndrome and feeling like, why isn't this working? You know, I'm clearly doing something wrong here. And so then I actually released a small game right after that, which took about a year of part-time development. And I worked on it with another developer and it was called Tic Tac Tanks. And I released it only on itch.io. And the process went way better. And that's kind of when I was getting an intuition for the book, you know, at that time, like, okay, I'm starting to get an idea of what I was doing wrong and here's maybe a solution that I can use. And so when I finished that game, I kind of jumped into writing the book. I was really excited about the idea. I made a YouTube video about it actually, called How to Plan and Finish. I think it's How to Plan and Finish Your Game. Or maybe it's just How to Plan Your Game. But I have a YouTube video with some title like that. And I got really excited about the book and wanted to write it. But then as I was writing it, I was kind of like, I'm pulling from a lot of external places here to prove my point. And I think I wanted the book to be a little bit more personal. And I was able to pull in some personal stories throughout the book. But after finishing it, I was like, okay, I'm really gonna double down on this idea. I'm gonna take, you know, I guess practice what I preach. I'm gonna take the things that I wrote in my book and I'm really gonna apply them to my next project. In fact, the next 5 years, I have a plan out for the next 5 years of releasing a game every year. So this year I started prototyping in June. So I think May. I started prototyping in May. And over the last 3 months, I've made four or so prototypes and was throwing them in front of playtesters. Because one of the things that I talk about in the book is making sure that you get video footage or like at least you're there watching while your playtesters are playing the game. Because it's way easier to identify problem areas if you can watch people play it as opposed to having them send you feedback through text or something. So I was doing that with those prototypes. Every week I was sending some sort of a demo or prototype to somebody. Even I have my daughters play them too and watch them play. And that's been really helpful. I've actually gotten a lot of, learned a lot from them. And so I'm really, you know, using this process of like prototyping and then finding something that it seems to be working, and knowing that it's working because I'm watching them play and trying to apply that to this project. So Wassard, you know, that's the project that I'm working on right now. And the development for it has been much better again. It feels like this process is working for me than Demon Lock. And I can just anticipate this question in the podcast. I know some people are going to ask about Demon Lock. What's going on with it? And I'll just say that it's still in development, but it's kind of on the back burner right now.
It did come up, I believe, in my Discord.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you want your book to be more personal because, okay, so for a caveat here, neither one of us can really objectively rate our books or understand how the people are going to perceive them, right? From my perspective, my book is very impersonal because I don't really tell that many stories or talk about myself much. It's very personal in that it's my process and it comes from my experience and no one else would have written it quite this way. But your book, I found quite personal. There's some charming little anecdotes in here. Like for one, I mentioned this to my wife is you have this charming story about how you had this a habit of getting your hot chocolate in the morning, right? And I found that so relatable. I always get like a coffee or preferably some kind of nice, like a mocha latte if I can, if it's one of those days, right? But I found that so relatable. And you talked about how you use that as like a jumping off point. I forget the term you used, but it was like habit bouncing or
habit pairing.
Habit pairing. And, you know, you were getting to the kind of thing my book would get to, which is like, here's a tool you can use, like habit pairing, or I have all these graphs and charts and stuff, right? And but the way you got there was this nice personal story that, like, I think a good rating for any piece of literature or entertainment or anything is if it pops in your head later. You know what I mean? And I did later. I'm getting my coffee and I'm like, I bet Ben's getting his hot chocolate right now. We're both gonna go work on video games and YouTube videos. Like, how awesome, right? So anyway, just a perspective from me is that was interesting to hear that you wish the book was more personal because I found it nicely personal.
Yeah, I think that desire that's in me, you know, to make it more personal comes from when I was writing it. It felt not that it maybe personal isn't the right word for what I'm trying to describe, but when I was writing it, it felt. Let's make up some terms here. You know, we're just talking about me making up terms. I'm going to make up some new terms. It felt very declarative versus like introspective. So I want a book that's a little bit more like this was my experience and these are the things that I learned.
Ooh,
And the book that I wrote was a little bit more like I mean, there's some of that still. I do have that in there, you know, but there was also some of that's like, this is, you know, kind of a roadmap for how I think you should go about this. And this is what I recommend. And it's almost more of a, like, I'm recommending these things. And it's not that there was anything wrong with that in the book. I just want to be able to pull from more places in my own life, I think. And I did pull from some places in my own life. There's, like you said, there are definitely some anecdotes in there, but I think, you know, this experience of making a game using the process from the book and like documenting that on my podcast is going to give me a lot of material to pull from as I write more books or make updates to this one. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing it. It's one of the reasons why I started a podcast and stuff.
Nice. I love that. It's interesting you talk about the type of advice. Like, I'm similar to you where I'm like, look, here's a way you could do it. And like, I think I get the quotes right. So my book starts with my favorite game dev, Derek Yu. I don't believe that there's a right way to make games. The first like actual, you know, content or whatever you want to call it, the first real words in the book pretty much is I'm like, I try to set the stage for like I don't know what I'm talking about. There's a section on imposter syndrome where I'm like, nobody really knows. But I think that I don't necessarily always hit that tone. I think it is a little like you, like sometimes the wording, I'm like, this is the way and you should. And sometimes it is. And sometimes I do mean to hit that tone, but most of the time I want to be like, hey, you could try this. It worked for me. And like, I love that it worked for me because it's impossible to argue with that or this is the way I like it because I tried it. You know, and I tried two different ways and I can compare those or something. But yeah, I think if there's another book, I will definitely try to hit that tone a little better where it's like, because I firmly like nobody. We don't know what we're doing. Nobody does. You know what I mean? And like you could write a whole book. Like we have. Do we really know what we're doing? Like a little, but like there's no true experts who have all the answers, right? And that's yeah. I appreciate that kind of a approach to the advice.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good segue into Wasard, because you correct me if I'm wrong. You're building the game with the principles of production point. Is that right?
Yeah. So the main idea from the book is you split development process into two parts. One of them is an exploratory phase or a sampling period, and the other one is an exploitative phase, which that word sounds kind of wrong, you know, but really what it just means is like a doubling down on what's already working. And so I've started that process with Wasard, and I started with, you know, making a bunch of prototypes and then putting those prototypes in front of people to try and see what's working. And it helps remove that main project syndrome where you're like, oh, this is the project. This is the one. I have to get it right or else, oh no, I've, you know, my reputation is going to be out the window or whatever. Mm-hmm. It removes that kind of pressure around the project because you're just making a bunch of little ideas. And then you, so during pre-production, there's this sampling period, right? And you're putting your game in front of players. And then you try to get it to a vertical slice or like a demo. And the purpose of pre-production is to remove uncertainty around your game. And what that means is going to depend on your game, but maybe you have some uncertainty around the art that you're going to use and whether or not people will like it. Or maybe you have uncertainty around some gameplay mechanics and some systems. And so the only way to really remove that uncertainty is to implement those things into a demo and then put it in front of people and watch them react. And as you remove that uncertainty, you move yourself closer and closer to that point, the production point, where you can switch. Early in pre-production, you're focused on exploring and trying new things. And then in production, it's like, okay, I figured it out now. I just need to make more of what was already working. People already like this. I just need to make more of it and turn it into a full game. And I've been doing that with Wasard. I've been in pre-production, and even having written the book, I'm still like, if you listen to the podcast, I'm still like, am I ready for production? You know, it's like, that's a really hard question to answer sometimes. And if the more experience you have as a developer, I think the better you can answer that question, because certain uncertainties have already been removed from previous projects, you know, like, oh, can I do saving and loading? It, you know, like that might be an uncertainty from a technical standpoint if it's your very first project. But if you've done a project with saving and loading before, then it's like, well, I know how to do that. I don't have to implement that before I jump into production. And so that kind of point is going to be different. But I've been with Wasard. I don't know. Like, I guess I could describe a little bit of how the process went for the game. I'd made a prototype that was kind of like Binding of Isaac meets, what's that? A Link's Awakening. Binding of Isaac and Link's Awakening. It was kind of like a mix between those. And I made this prototype and it was like, okay. I took a month to make it and tried to get it to like a demo and put it in front of my brothers, and like when they'd play it, they wouldn't really keep at it. They would play it and then they'd just kind of stop. And I could tell that it was like not really that great. So then I started working on another prototype that was I think Spelunky and Hollow Knight mixed. That's kind of the best way that I could describe it.
Speaking my language.
Yeah, Spelunky, right? I wanted something that was like Spelunky, but with a movement more similar to Hollow Knight. That prototype fizzled out way fast. It was like a week, and I was already bored of it. And I was like, if I'm bored of it, I don't even need to put it in front of other people, you know? Like, I mean, I did, but it just wasn't working. I don't know why. And so I actually pivoted. Like, my plan was to make a prototype each month. And then the first week of that month, I could tell that that one wasn't working. So I just immediately pivoted away from it. And I had an idea for a game that was like, I'd been reading Steam reviews, actually. And
that's painful.
Not my own, other people's. So okay. A lot less. Those are usually painful. Fun. Yeah. I'd been reading Steam reviews, and somebody in the reviews was talking about all these new WASD games that were coming out and how they liked them because, you know, they could have their kid on their lap and just play with their one hand. And I was like, I'm a dad. I relate to that, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I wonder if I could, and I'd been playing Binding of Isaac again recently. And I was like, I wonder if I could do like a WASD Binding of Isaac. And that's kind of what inspired Wassered. And since the other game, the other prototype had used, you know, Binding of Isaac as an inspiration, I could steal a bunch of code from that prototype. And I did. I stole a bunch of code from it, reworked the player, and just really started focusing in on that. I started with just one room with some enemies and like, is this fun? You know? And in my book, I call that the toy, which is kind of the thing about the game that's fun if you remove like any sort of goals. Like, what are the players going to do if you don't really incentivize them to do anything? What's going to be fun? And like, there's always going to be some incentives, but like, if you're not rewarding them with like coins and stuff, you know, like, what are they going to do? And that build, like, pretty early on, people were playing it a lot and replaying it. And that's what I was looking for. I knew that the project I was making was going to be small and that I needed to find a project that people would replay. And so I remember I had an early demo of it and I went to like a family get together. My family does like a we call it the meet for the treat. And it's this on Sunday evenings, we'll all go to somebody's house and they'll host and they'll make a treat and we all just eat the treat and visit, you know, whatever the treat is. It's ice cream or cookies.
That is delightful.
And so I brought my Steam Deck to this, you know, and I gave the game to my cousin and he was playing it. And like earlier, my daughter had been playing it and just kept asking to replay it all the time. And they just kept replaying it. And then my cousin was playing it and my brother was playing it. And they just, at the family gathering, you know, they played it for like a couple hours and they kept replaying it. And I was like, okay, this is working, you know? And I didn't feel like Yeah, that's what I was looking for. I was like, okay, this is the one to double down on. And that's what I've been doing is doubling down. But like, I'm still not sure if I'm actually at that point, like at the production point, because there's like the toy part. And then there's like a part of game development where you have to scale it up and you have to kind of make sure that you're scaling the difficulty of it well. And I still feel like I'm kind of figuring that out with it. But it's like mostly there. So I don't know.
This sounds like Content Mountain. When you said the word scaling, you know, we talk about, the language for stuff, right? When you say scaling the mountain. And every time I think of that point where the game is like, okay, can you take this? Like in our Discord, we talk a lot about game time, right? And it's really easy to get like 30 seconds of pretty cool gameplay, but like, how can you give me now 45 minutes? Give me now 2 hours. And that's when people start to sweat. Like you can see the developers like,
especially indies. They're like, wait,
hang on. Yeah, there's an axe. You can chop a tree. Could you chop trees for 14 hours? Like, this is my only plan here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, I feel like that's a question that needs to be at least somewhat answered before you move on to production as well. And you know, my first release, Endhall, I think that's where the game falls apart. Like, it struggled to be able to scale up from where it was. And you know, I have one review that's like, one reviewer that was like, and I have this in my book too. He's like, do you wish developers charged for demos? That's how he starts the review. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah, that's and rough. He's, you went into the lion's den.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit harsh in the presentation, but they're right too. Like they were right in the sense that it was a very short game that didn't really scale well. Even though it like even though every time you play it, the levels are randomly generated and stuff. There's not really a big reason to replay it, like once you've beaten it. So they were right, and that's a tough thing to do. It's something that I still feel like I'm learning, is how to scale from here. But like I, you know, I say I have a hard time saying whether or not the project's at the production point or not, and it's a tough decision because that's the point where you do actually commit. You know, you stop prototyping, you stop exploring, you do actually commit, and you commit to finishing the project, and you have the confidence to know that what you had was good because you already established that it was good in pre-production. And it's pretty hard to mess up at that point. I think it's possible to mess it up, but you know, I think it's difficult to mess it up at that point. And so you really can commit and finish the game from there.
Yeah, it is so hard to know what point you're at any given stage, whether your concept is any good, whether you picked the right engine, like all these questions you have, right? I was talking with my brother, who's also a game developer. He's like more of the AAA 3D space. So he's like well outside of the humble indie 2D pixel art that you and I make. So we were talking about game design pillars, and he gave me something useful, which was a good game design pillar is one that helps you answer questions. Right. And something nice and contained and articulate, like tiny like that, I find really useful because in some of my because I have so many, you know, folders for games. Right. And in all of them, I have game design pillars, and some of them are just not useful. And it's because I didn't have that barometer for like, is this even a good game design pillar? Like one of them was like accessible. Maybe that is a good pillar even, but like, I guess the point being that I need better tools for even knowing if what I'm doing is the right type of tool. You know what I mean? It's like, you need, like I need sometimes like a meta chart for my charts to make sure I'm on the right path.
Yeah. When you're saying that, it makes me think of like, it answers a question. And I think that's what removing the uncertainty is to me. Like when I talk about removing the uncertainty, I'm talking about answering questions, and like which questions are important. That's another question, right? In and of itself. Yeah. But I think the most obvious question is like, do people like it? And as an indie developer, I think, are they replaying it is an important question too, because we just can't compete content wise, you know, like two person teams, even three person teams, you're never going to compete content wise with AAA developers. So you have to compete with replay value, in my opinion. Like that's where we have to stand out. If we're gonna provide a lot of value to the players, the way that we provide a lot of value to them is through replay value. You look at games like Tetris, and it's like the smallest game, but it has so much replay value to it that it can really, you know, give the gamers their a lot of bang for their buck, right? And gamers, they really appreciate that when we take the time to make something that they will enjoy for, you know, tens, hundreds of hours, and they can pay $5 for it or $10 for it. You know, a lot of these games that are doing well on Steam, it's because of that kind of thing. They have such high replay value that it doesn't need tons of content. And I don't want to say this is the only way to go about it as an indie game developer. There are a lot of indie games out there that are short and that are, you don't really want to play them again. They're not designed to be played again. I mean, I think of A Short Hike, for example. That's a good example. One of my favorite indie games out there. And clearly, even though it's a very short game, gamers love it and they felt like it was well worth the price. That developer figured out how to provide value in some other way, right? But I think for me, the question for me is replay value. Can I make something that people will play over and over again and enjoy? And those are like really important questions. And side note, I have to throw this in here. The developer of A Short Hike also had a big, huge project that he was working on that was maybe had some main project syndrome. I don't know. They'd have to speak to that themselves, but they made
like
a they made a short hike on the side, and it ended up being highly successful.
So a short hike developer is Adam Robinson Yu. And the reason I remember that is because I quoted Adam in my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself, everybody, out now on Amazon.com for $14.99.
I have as well, by the way, funny story. I bought it before we even met.
I love that. That is that's my dream, right? That's amazing. So Adam Robinson Yu, I decided to put aside my main project and just work on this tiny little project. And I take this to heart all the time. I think it's like when us indies work in these tiny little spaces, you can make a brand new project in like a week. You can turn your ship around in like a week. I did this recently. I was struggling with Witchmore, and then I just pivoted and I started working on a prototype where it was leaner, it was meaner, and I was way faster and more experienced with it. And a week later, I was having more fun than I was currently in Witchmore. You know what I mean? I know that this is actually a question. I don't know if we'll get to it. Maybe this is a great segue to it, but we have a bunch of great list of questions, but one of them was how to finish a project without starting a new one, right? Which is one of the biggest indie problems. But sometimes I straight up recommend that. I quote it in the book, and I think it's main project syndrome, as you were talking about. I think that this is one of the cures, right? It is to at least step away from it, maybe start something else. Because, I just got to mention this, a short hike is a genius name, because I think it literally alleviates the pain of a gamer who will find it and be like, this is too short. It's the second word in the title. You know, if you do, if you remove the A, it's the first word. Short, it sets the stage, which was just genius, because if it was called a long hike, or
a mountain hike, let's say it's called a mountain hike, right?
The big mountain, right? Yeah. Like a huge mountain to climb, and you're like, hey, I beat it in so and so hours. Anyway, I know
it set the stage for the developer too,
right? If they had the name baked in early on, I've called before I know the name, sometimes I'll give my game projects little names to help inspire them, right? And help me talk about them. One time I called it Dirk, like a dagger, because I was like, it needs to be, maybe it was Shiv, but it was like, what's, because we were using names like dagger and sword and halberd. This is from my old company, LDG. And we were we need something smaller, like tiny, like one syllable, you know what I mean?
Small, but it stabs, there's
effective.
There was this is like a course or something that I was advertised by another developer, another game developer, and we might have to put this in the show notes as well if people are interested in this. It's no longer for sale. It was like a course that was like a limited time thing or something. But in his video, he talked about one of the phrases that he said that stood out to me was, be the king of a small hill instead of the pawn of a big mountain or something. And I was like, that's what we need to do. We need small but very effective, at least starting out. And that doesn't mean you should always make small games, but with the question about quitting, let's go back to the listener question real quick before we move on from that, right?
Sure.
How to finish a project without starting a new one, because I wanted to answer that. Like you said, you even recommend quitting sometimes, and I do too.
Sometimes
the solution can be a question for which phase you're in or which phase of production, right? If you're in pre-production, quit. Just quit. Do something else. If it's not working, then move on. And that you're in pre-production because it's still not working. If you have something that's working, you're ready for production. But if it's not working, just quit. Get out of there. I mean, you can try to fix stuff some, but don't waste a lot of time trying to fix something that isn't working. Pivot, move on. And there's actually a quote from Tom Francis in my book that I wanted to, since we're both quoting from our books,
I love it.
The book battle,
book battle.
So there's a quote from Tom. There's a quote here from Tom Francis. He wrote a short GDC talk during lockdown. And in the talk, he says, I think giving up is sometimes stigmatized as an act of self-doubt, but I see it as an act of faith in yourself. When you're working on something that's showing no signs of working out, giving up on that is saying, I trust myself to come up with something better. And I just love that quote. It's like, If you're working on something, it's not working out, just quit, move on. If you're in production and you're struggling because, you know, it's hard to make a game, it's hard to make a lot of content, but you know that what you have is working, what you have is good, then maybe you just need a break, you know. Maybe you need a break and you can come back to making that content. But at that point, my rule is I'm not going to quit. I'm in production. I'm going to finish this thing. Even if that means cutting some of the content and shipping earlier, you can finish it because you know what you have is good and that it's working.
Right. Yeah. What's interesting is we see games at every stage of development fail, right? And we see developers of every single size do that, like fail at almost every single stage. Like the biggest AAA game studios will have some game they'll put out and be like, hey, and then it's like, no one likes it. And they're like, never mind. Like they do the same stuff we do. They just do it on a different scale. So this question was probably one of the most asked. And I think this comes up because you have all these awesome game dev tutorials, right? You've taught like a legion of new developers how to make games. And they're very curious what your taste is with Engine these days, what you're using, because, you know, when you make the engines, they're really super tied to the version sometimes, right? When you're in there literally in like, a, you know, Godot 3.2, you know, you've got this really a popular tutorial about that. And like, you know, when the version changes, oh, now it's in Godot 4, like you had some requests to hit that again, you know, that can change how you the entire workflow. Like, you know, if you're watching videos, you might hit a wall, like, oh no, Godot 4 changed how everything works. But yeah, you've jumped around a lot. You're polyglot, you know, multiple languages, how to use multiple engines. So what are you using now? What do you prefer and why?
Yeah, so I'm using Godot right now. For the game that I'm working on, I'm using Godot 4, 4.1 just came out. I have found that I really love using Godot for making games. And I switched off of GameMaker back when GameMaker Studio 2 came out. And I was reading through the listener questions on Twitter, and they mentioned that, you know, there's been a lot of improvements to GameMaker since I've switched off. Would I ever consider coming back to GameMaker? And the answer to that question is yes, I would consider coming back, but the main deterrent for me with GameMaker has been the new workspaces. Workspaces were introduced in Godot or in GameMaker Studio 2, and there's a whole bunch of other features with GameMaker Studio 2 that all look amazing, and I'm like, yeah, I love that. I love that new feature, but workspaces are kind of this really negative experience for me. I don't like using them at all. I feel awkward using them. I never got comfortable with them. And that's ultimately why I ended up switching over to Godot. Now that I'm using Godot, obviously, it's really nice that it's open source. I can't complain there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it has a pretty bright future. It's interesting because I still miss making GameMaker tutorials because I actually enjoyed making tutorials in GameMaker more. And so I'm in this weird position where like I prefer making games in Godot, but I preferred making tutorials in GameMaker. And it's like this really weird position to be in.
Why is that? What is it about GameMaker that makes you prefer the tutorials?
I think it's because the GameMaker's kind of approach, like its philosophy to making stuff, is a lot more straightforward. As an example, in GameMaker you have an object and you have events on that object, and then you could have like scripts or functions or whatever, but it's basically you just have objects, and all objects are objects, right? When you want to make a bullet, you make an object. When you want to make a player, you make an object. Whatever you want to make, it's an object, right? And then you have rooms, and it's like, okay, rooms are like the levels, and you put these objects in those rooms. It's really straightforward. I learned with GameMaker, and it's very straightforward, as opposed to Godot, which has like nodes and scenes. And if you want to make a character, it's like, well, you need to use a node, but the node that you use will depend on the kind of game that you're making. Mm. And like, are you making a platform game? Then you'll probably want to use a kinematic character. Or are you making this? Then you want to use a different node. And it's just like, it feels like there's a lot of setup. So that's the main difference. Like making tutorials in Game Maker was a lot more straightforward, and I could kind of jump right to the meat of the tutorial right away. Where with Godot, it feels like there's more setup. But like making games, it's nice because Godot feels like the setup is there. But then I can write my own tools and stuff that will like remove that setup and make it fast. But I don't feel like I can use a bunch of tools or external things in tutorial videos. So then, yeah, like developing in Godot is fun, but then making tutorials, it feels like I have to start from scratch almost every time. And that process has a lot of setup.
I see. Yeah. I think that Unity and Godot's approaches make a lot of sense. Like in Unity, everything's a game object. Like the UI is slightly different. There's like kind of two renderers that I don't love about it. And Godot has that kind of thing where everything is an object, right? I really prefer an entity component system, right? Yeah. Like that's just how I drastically have, I'm faster, I'm better. It's cleaner. It makes more sense to me. I just love everything about it more. And like, I know Unity has a dot system, but like, I'm not going to rewrite all my stuff, you know what I mean? But yeah, what's interesting is like, if I were to make a product like an engine, I wouldn't really recommend an entity component system for newer people, because it's like a lot to wrap your head around. I think just, you know, like you were saying with Game Maker, look, there's an object in a room, like that's all you need for 90%, like Tetris, chess, just off the top of my head, Spelunky, I mean, World of Warcraft, a bunch of objects in a room, if you, right?
Yeah.
So like that gets you where you need to be. And like, do you really, like, for example, in my current entity component system, the UI is entity components. It's bizarre. So like, if you save the state, you save the windows, you save like the title screen is saved. And if I want to introduce a new title screen, I would have to like wipe some user data or something, right? Like it's better for the reality of game development for my tastes. But for usability and like, Unity is great because like even people who aren't very technical can come in and like, there's a user interface. It's like, yeah, just drag a new image into this folder and add a data file. And yeah, you did some game dev right there. Boom. You know, like that's not as easy with a lot of entity components. I mean, you can always make like an interface on top of it or whatever, but like, you know, all my stuff is just pure code. So like Unity is this, like when I go back and forth between my projects, like in my ACS, it's all code. And it's like someone else would be like, this is a nightmare. I'm happy. But then I go to Unity, lovely interface, you know, color dropper. You could drag an X and Y coordinate. I can see a visual square around an object. Like the usability is just there, right? But it's just not how, like, I could see how Unity would make for better tutorials. Like if I was making an ECS tutorial, it'd be so boring. It'd be just lots of typing. You know what I mean? So going back to Game Maker, it sounds like a maybe.
Yeah, going back to Game Maker is a if they were to remove the workspace system and replace that with some other type of system, then I would give it another try.
So workspaces are, you have to use them? There's no opt out or
I mean, people, there is a way around them, but the way around them is just as much of a pain as the workspaces for me personally.
I see.
It just gives you a bunch of tabs instead, and I don't like that either. So workspaces were designed, I feel like it was designed for like artists. Like you've got this giant monitor and you've got this giant workspace, and you can like move around in the workspace and your code's like in the workspace. And it also feels like that it was kind of designed for the drag and drop system in Game Maker, which I always like. I've mainly used the programming language in it, and so then it didn't really mesh well for me.
Yeah, it's fascinating seeing, like I remember in your first podcast, you were talking about how your focus on your tutorials was very successful and going well, but it kind of took you away from your real dream, which was to make games. So relatable to me, because when I launched my company Valadria about a year and a half ago or something, it was along with my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. I spent a long time just promoting the book. It's what this podcast is all about, like all these different things. And then I'll see some, like a friend releases a game and they're like, yeah, I finished it. And I'm like, oh, like, why didn't I finish a game? Like, it's because of, you know, it's because of these 40 YouTube videos and this, you know, like working on another book or another article or whatever. But yeah, in your podcast, which I'll put a link, of course, in the show notes, to the podcast, I found that super relatable. The like, you know, you want to be helpful and you want to put out good stuff. And people are like, yeah, I want more tutorials. And like, we're happy to make them and stuff. But But then once in a while, you want to like, you want to get your fingers back into the creativity, and you want to make a game, right?
Yeah. And I've experienced that same thing with seeing, you know, like seeing my students even kind of living out the dream that I originally set out to live, and me being like, huh, you know, I've been doing like, this for 10 years now, and my students are, you know, going on, and I'm like super happy for them, but also a little bit jealous, you know, like, oh,
totally.
I've got students, some of the students that I know, one's working on One Lonely Outpost, which released in early access recently. It was a highly successful Kickstarter.
Nice.
Then another student who is working on Crowsworn, which was kind of like a Bloodborne Hollow Knight mashup. And it was like $1 million Kickstarter. And
oh, wow.
You know, like I'm seeing, I have another student who released a game which released on Switch and PlayStation and, you know, a bunch of different platforms, and like I'm really happy for them and it's amazing, but I'm like, you know, it's time for me to make a game and like really really focus in on game development, and maybe I can teach people through this book and through my podcast, and you know, like still teach people but be able to pursue this dream of releasing games consistently.
That's really cool. I think it's so exciting. I read Production Point. I love it. I've been thinking about it a lot. I've beginning to integrate it into my process, and I'm really excited to follow along with Wessard and your other game dev pursuits through your podcast and your amazing YouTube channel. And just thanks a lot for being here today. This has been great.
Yep. Thanks for having me, Matt.
To follow and support Ben, subscribe to You Heart Beast on YouTube, wishlist Wassard on Steam, and buy Ben's book, Production Point. To follow and support me, subscribe to Valadria on YouTube, add Pixel Washer to your Steam washlist, and buy my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. Coming soon is my 251st podcast with LostCast co-host Jeff Blair. Subscribe to Make the Game with Matt Hackett for more. Now it's time for you to go make the game.
Just replace that section with a deep fake of me talking.